Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. Well, as you know, folks, if you have been tuned into this program at all, among the challenges the country we love faces at the moment, as a combination of factors have been forcing to the fore, is the effort of so-called globalists of various ideological stripes to supplant, well, the country we love, the constitutional republic that is America, with something they call euphemistically global governance. What on earth is that? And what would it mean for you, your freedoms, your country? Well, to answer that very important question and to discuss why we must address it forthrightly, seriously, and hopefully decisively to reject such a, well, global governance gambit, I call it, I'm very pleased to have with us Alex Newman. He is an extraordinarily impressive international journalist, an author, an educator, a public speaker. He's, in his spare time, an investor and a consultant. He is the president of Liberty Sentinel Media, and he contributes prolifically to various outlets, including the New American Magazine, WND, Freedom Project Media, and more. He has been studying and writing and assessing throughout his career the United Nations and other organizations associated with it and not, including the World Health Organization, and has become really one of the go-to individuals in America about this assault on our sovereignty. We're very proud to have him as a member of our Sovereignty Coalition and delighted always to have him as a guest here at Securing America. Alex, despite that long introduction, there's much I want to hear from you about, and I'm very appreciative of you taking the time to talk with us today. Welcome back to Securing America.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much, Frank.
So I think our audience is reasonably schooled up on what's going on here, Alex, but would you talk a little bit about the play that is being made by, among others, let's be clear, the Biden administration, to have the World Health Organization, well, amp up on steroids, I guess, the kind of authority and power that it exercised during the recent COVID pandemic, and what the implications of that would be were they to succeed?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. And so the Biden administration has been relentlessly promoting what they kind of euphemistically describe as international cooperation, multilateral programs. And that sounds very non-threatening, but when you sort through kind of the marketing slogans and the focus group tested, platitudes, what we're really talking about here ultimately is an undermining of U.S. sovereignty, an undermining of self-government, an undermining of our ability through our elected representatives to make our own decisions. And so this is happening on a whole bunch of different fronts. I think one of the most important ones being healthcare. And I said one of the most important ones being healthcare because healthcare is something that touches every single person, from the smallest baby to the oldest person on the planet. Everybody intersects with somewhere the healthcare system. And communists have long understood. In fact, it was widely reported that some of the leading communists said that government-controlled healthcare was the keystone of socialism. And it's because, as the World Health Organization has made clear, they believe that everything runs through health. So I was in Egypt at the UN Climate Summit some months ago, and you had a Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the former communist terrorist, former Politburo member of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, claiming that climate change was a global health crisis. We've seen them talking about how gun violence is allegedly a health crisis. Racism is a health crisis. In other words, everything, in their view, is a healthcare issue. And if we're going to empower the World Health Organization, which is what's happening, everybody should be clear, the effort here that is taking place is to empower the World Health Organization. How far they'll get this year is really not the point. Whether they take a huge leap forward, to borrow a slogan from Chairman Mao, or whether they take small baby steps, they're always moving in the same direction. That is further usurping power, further usurping sovereignty, further expanding the powers of these centralized mechanisms that, again, they euphemistically refer to as global governance. But the end objective, and they've made this clear from the very beginning. I mean, go back and read John Foster Dulles' book, War or Peace, published in 1950. He was the Secretary of State who oversaw a lot of this. And it was very clear and very transparent. The ultimate objective is to create what he described as world federation, or world government. In fact, those are the terms that he used. And so we see that now coming into view. I think the World Health Organization gambit that we just saw over the last couple of weeks, meeting in Geneva, trying to amend the international health regulations, trying to move forward this international pandemic accord, which I think they hope to have ready to go by next year's World Health Assembly. All of these are moving us in that direction of letting the WHO determine what sort of healthcare people should have, what that delivery model should look like. They actually released a major report by this council that they put together. And you can just read the press release and understand what this is about. They want to centralize government control over research, over development, over healthcare delivery. And they even frame this as if you had some sort of human right to WHO-approved, government-controlled healthcare. This is very, very dangerous what we're dealing with here. And I think it is important to emphasize again, it's not just on the healthcare front. That's just the issue that's in front of us right now. They're doing this on environmental issues. They're doing this on technology. They're doing this on the internet, right? For years and years, they had a CCP operative running the International Telecommunications Union, openly working toward, in their own documents, global regulation, global control of the internet. And when you put all these pieces together, the agenda is very, very clear.
Yeah, and that's an excellent summation. You touched on one point that I want to elaborate on. You mentioned that the internet governance operation was run by a CCP operative. That would be, of course, the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communists have also been responsible for plucking a communist Ethiopian from the obscurity of, I guess, terrorist activities in his native country to become the director general of the World Health Organization. This would be Tedros Ghebreyesus, you mentioned earlier. Discuss, they're all about one world government, to be sure, and have been, you know, throughout the life of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think John Foster Dulles was warning about, you know, this agenda, not espousing it, right? But the main point is that what these guys have in mind, using a favored tactic of totalitarians, is playing to people's fears about their health or their safety to justify arrangements that will ultimately constrict both, if not, as we saw in this pandemic, result in the deaths of perhaps as many as a million Americans, maybe more. Talk about the role of the Chinese Communist Party in all of this and their, you know, presence in not just, as you say, this particular international outfit, but so many of them.
Yeah, the CCP is the 8 billion pound dragon shrieking in the corner of the room that nobody wants to talk about. It is now a ubiquitous presence, a ubiquitous force, not just in the WHO, but across all of the major UN agencies. So the UN has 15 specialized agencies, they call them. And of those, about one third are in the hands of an actual card carrying CCP member, Chinese national. Many of the others, like Tedros Ghebreyesus, were specifically selected by the CCP and installed by the CCP. In fact, when they put Tedros Ghebreyesus in there, there were multiple diplomats speaking out, off the record, of course, because they didn't want to be retaliated against, saying that the Communist Chinese were using bribery and blackmail to make sure they had enough votes to get this guy in there. So why does the most murderous dictatorship in the history of humanity have this zeal to install its minions and people who are serving its agenda at the head of these international agencies? Well, they're not doing it because they love you. They're not doing it because they want you to be healthy. They're not doing it for the benefit of the United States of America. They're doing it to control more people, more resources to advance their agenda. And I think, as we saw so clearly over the last few years, to cripple their enemies, right? So many of the
hold policies- the thought. We have to be right back with more Axel Neumann right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, globalists at the European Union and World Health Organization unveiled a landmark digital health partnership to, quote, facilitate global mobility and protect citizens across the world from ongoing and future health threats, unquote. We're promised, moreover, that, quote, this first building block of the World Health Organization Global Digital Health Certification Network will deliver better health for all, unquote. Actually, what you'll get with this health partnership is international aggregation of your personal data, surveillance, control, and abuse. Even before that dark day arrives, as Dr. Robert Malone has pointed out, bureaucrats in the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology have already launched a national digital health ID here without debate or voters' informed consent. Think of it as your passport to the digital gulag. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with one of the most fascinating people I know, Alex Neumann, a journalist by trade, but a man of great perspicacity, especially when it comes to some of the complexities of what is going on in our world that is, I think, not getting the attention that is required, specifically threats to our sovereignty emanating from Chinese Communist Party, as we were discussing at the end of the last segment, but also the Biden administration, the World Economic Forum, Bill Gates, Big Pharma. It sounds like a giant conspiracy theory, except it's not a theory. It's a conspiracy. And they're using instruments like the World Health Organization to advance this bid for some new elite-run globalist governance scheme that has a lot of trappings of the sort of totalitarian one-world government that the communists have historically sought and are now arguably closer to achieving than ever. I apologize. You were doing such a great job laying out what the Chinese communists have been up to, Alex, that time got away from me. We had to truncate your comment there a little bit. Did you have a final point you'd like to make on that? And then I want to back the lens up and talk about some of these other actors who are also, conniving at the moment, mostly behind the Soji screen, as they say, behind closed doors in Geneva, Switzerland, to generate one arrangement or another, international health regulation amendments or some new accord to essentially sacrifice our sovereignty and that of other nations, of course, to this new health enterprise.
Yeah, I think the key point, Frank, the key takeaway is that the CCP is very active. They are very deliberately going into these international organizations, grabbing as much power as they can. They now dominate many of these organizations, policymaking, policy implementation. They actually have set up a school of global governance to train up legions, an army of diplomats, so-called, to go take over these organizations. And even when they're not specifically running the organization, what you often find is they're operating and their minions. And this goes all the way to the top of the United Nations. You know, Antonio Guterres seems like this nice, friendly Portuguese guy. But if you look at his background, he also has a background in the extreme radical left. In fact, he was a member of the Socialist Party. He was the former leader of the Socialist International. And the Socialist International, its members include many mass murdering communist parties and rebranded communist parties. And many of these people operate at the highest levels of the United Nations as well. And you know, they've actually been very clear about their end objective for a very long time. Communists have always wanted a global system of communism. And so we shouldn't be surprised that they would be grabbing these institutions that already have global reach, that already have at least some semblance of legitimacy to try to advance their objectives. And as you look at the patterns emerging, it really should be very obvious at this point to everyone what's going on. They are using these international organizations to advance their agenda, to undermine their geopolitical adversaries, like, of course, the United States of America. And unfortunately, they are now doing it with the deliberate assistance of the Biden administration. The Trump administration was a very different thing. Of course, Trump got us out of the WHO and really was like a one-man human wrecking ball when it came to this architecture of global governance. But Biden has gone fully in the opposite direction, not just re-engaging, but almost desperately seeking to throw away and give away our national sovereignty. People should be very concerned about this.
They should indeed, especially since it's, as I say, happening mostly, you know, below the radar horizon and unbeknownst, even, I think, to most members of Congress who presumably would find this objectionable if they did know, as would, I think, the vast majority of Americans. The other piece of this that I just wanted to ask you to address, Alex, because I know you're thinking several moves down the chessboard as we need to. Before there is a new agreement of one kind or another in the World Health Organization, before there is an arrangement in the UN General Assembly, which we're told is in the offing come September, whereby this fellow Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, will have sort of similar powers to those that these guys are seeking for Tedros Ghebreyesus in the health space by giving him responsibility for, I think they're calling it something like global complex crises, which is a catch-all for everything else, I guess. They're building infrastructure to essentially effect the kind of control that they see. It's very reminiscent, as I see it, in these digital identification cards, ostensibly for health monitoring purposes, but essentially platforms that are indistinguishable from those that the Chinese communists use for their social credit system. The ultimate, you know, totalitarian control device. Talk a little bit about this component of the agenda, this infrastructure build out, along, I guess, with the World Economic Forum that is also in this game. And in addition, if you would, the extent to which we here in the United States are having a parallel effort being made under the guise of something called the National Digital ID, as I understand it.
Yeah, so there is a global agenda, and there has been for many years. A lot of people think this was a response to COVID. It absolutely was not. Years before anybody ever heard of a COVID, Bill Gates, the Rockefellers, and others came up with this ID 2020. They put up a website, and they said what the goal was, that every person on planet Earth needs to have a digital ID. And so think of kind of vaccine passport combined with Communist Chinese social credit score system, where, you know, you are ranked based on your obedience to the Communist Party, you know, whether you're asking pesky questions, whether you charge your cell phone, whether you pay your mortgage, all of this gets factored in. Think of like an ESG score, but for a person rather than a company. And then making it impossible to operate without this, not just to be able to travel, right? The World Health Organization is looking at this from the health certificate perspective, from the vaccine passport directive, where you wouldn't be able to cross borders without this. But they have a much bigger plan than just the healthcare information. They want you to be able to interact with government using this. And ultimately, Klaus Schwab, who's kind of the front man for this agenda right now, a very big fan of the Communist Chinese system, very close to these international organizations. In fact, his organization, the World Economic Forum, is a strategic partner of the United Nations in implementing Agenda 2030, which the head of the General Assembly called the Master Plan for Humanity. The Secretary General at the time, Ban Ki-moon, called the Global Declaration of Interdependence. And so the WEF and its head, its nominal front man, Klaus Schwab, have said that the agenda ultimately is going to go much further than this. Klaus Schwab talks about, and he has for many years now, this phenomenon that he has labeled the fourth industrial revolution, which sounds non-threatening enough because the previous industrial revolutions, they liberated humanity from a lot of backbreaking labor. I think we all have kind of positive feelings toward industrialization and the increase in prosperity. But this fourth industrial revolution is radically different. And so Klaus Schwab has summarized the end goal of this in his own words, in multiple speeches, in multiple languages, as a kind of fusion of our digital and our biological and our physical identities. And so we won't have time to break down the full implications of that, but recognize these are people who do not believe in fundamental American principles. They do not believe that God created us equally and gave us certain unalienable rights that cannot be restricted by government. In fact, they believe that they would run our lives much better than we would run them ourselves. And this digital ID, which is already being piloted in multiple states, and which, as you pointed out, the federal government is working toward, all of this combines together to create really a panopticon kind of global surveillance state, global control grid, with the CCP style policies leading the way. And, you know, for people who love freedom, for people who enjoy prosperity, these things should be considered absolutely unacceptable.
Unacceptable and mortally perilous. In fact, the European Union and the WHO just yesterday launched something they call the Landmark Digital Health Partnership. And they're promising that this is going to be so much more efficient and helpful and travel and identity, mobility and so on. This is the brave new world, it seems to me. And that's not a good thing, industrial revolution or otherwise. Alex, we have to have you back on for a longer chat. Thank you for your time today, as well as your great expertise. It's so appreciated and so desperately needed. Keep up the good work, my friend, and come back to us soon. Talk a little bit more about all of this with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald right after this.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by another expert on the challenge posed to this country by, well, communists, Marxists, socialists, and others seeking world governance, the destruction of the United States, and otherwise the end of freedom. His name is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He knows whereof he speaks on all of these matters, because not only is he a distinguished PhD and professor, but he's a former Marxist himself and has come in from the cold and is now, I think, one of the free world's most thoughtful, certainly knowledgeable experts on the challenge that we're facing from the ideologues with whom he previously associated. He's the author of some 11 books, including Thought Criminal, Beyond Woke, The Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag, and The Simulation of Freedom. Dr. Rechtenwald, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Great to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
I can't imagine a better sort of introduction to you and your insights than what we just heard from Alex, and I know you were able to listen into a bit of it. Just a quick reaction. Is world governance the agenda that these guys are pursuing, and what would it mean for the freedom of the American people and our constitutional republic were they to succeed?
Absolutely. Global governance, as they call it, is the agenda. This has been on the agenda of the UN since its inception, really. It's been accelerated through Agenda 2030, which is the agenda of the UN to usher in its so-called sustainable development goals. As Alex pointed out, the UN and the World Economic Forum established a partnership in 2019 to accelerate the ushering in of this Agenda 2030. And they have stated many times, the World Economic Forum, all over their website, about global governance being the necessary mechanism for meeting the sustainable development goals of Agenda 2030 and many other goals that they have in mind, in particular a so-called greener, fairer, greener future, as they put it. They think that global governance is necessary to usher this in, and they've been bringing it about and through the most surreptitious means imaginable, in particular by bringing on thousands of corporate partners to push this agenda through. This is they're surreptitiously bypassing legislative and democratic processes through the stakeholder capitalism regime and the ESG mechanism. So all of that is part and parcel of this global governance scheme.
This is such an important insight. And I wanted to ask you about one of those capitalist titans who seems, based on his recent travels in China, to be fully aligned with the Chinese Communist Party and doing their bidding, with, among other things, what he describes as the most advanced user of artificial intelligence in the world, namely his Tesla automotive company, and that would be, of course, Elon Musk. He also owns Twitter, and one of the things that is another ominous tell as to where he aligns is he seems to have just put into place as the new CEO of Twitter, somebody who is a full-on woke radical leftist. Have I got that right? And what are the implications?
Well, yes, Linda Yaccarino has been installed as the CEO of Twitter. And naturally, when she was installed, people started to look into her background. And it's very apparent right on her LinkedIn page. It says very clearly that she is a member of the World Economic Forum. She's the chairman of the WEF's Task Force on the Future of Work and sits on its Media, Environment, and Culture Industry Governors Steering Committee. She also notes that she's a, quote, global leader on her LinkedIn profile. And this, of course, brings to mind the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Forum, which is a training program that Schwab has claimed exerts enormous influence over leading political figures and others around the world. And so likewise, there's a great deal of reason to be concerned about this appointment if you have any concern for free speech and lack of censorship and the fact that Twitter may end up being what it was before Musk took over, even worse perhaps, and that is a space for driving these official narratives down our throats.
Yeah. And as we were talking about with Alex Newman a moment ago, the infrastructure that is being put into place for doing that, I mean, social media platforms like Twitter have been already, as you've indicated, active in, you know, managing disinformation and otherwise censoring people, as well as advancing the approved narratives of Big Pharma or, you know, the government of the United States or others.
Yeah.
But in addition to all of that, Michael, you've got this building out of this digital gulag. That's the way I think of it, with the help from the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization, among others. Is it an overstatement in your judgment that what that ultimately conduces to is something along the lines of what the Chinese have been building in the form of their so-called social credit system. Again, what are the implications of all that for our freedoms?
Yeah, I mean, they're enormous. And as we just saw, the WHO has entered into a digital partnership with the EU to extend its the EU's digital passport system, effectively is what it is, to all of the member, so-called member nations of the WHO. How we became a member nation of the WHO is a real question, except that we're a member nation of the UN. And so what this really amounts to is these member states being under total, the members in these member states being under total digital surveillance. They say it will help facilitate global mobility and protect citizens around the world from ongoing health threats. But really, when they say mobility and they say protection, what they really mean is restraints on movement and living for the unvaccinated and forced vaccination to participate in life itself. So, I mean, it's just unbelievable. Everything is doublespeak where these people are concerned. Anytime they say freedom of movement, they mean restraints. Anytime they say health, they mean their version of health, which is forced vaccinations and the inability to participate in life without such.
But this, as you know better than just about anybody, is, of course, a very well-established tactic of the left, is it not? I mean, it's all saying things that have the opposite meaning in practice and, right, and using these as a means of deceiving and deflecting attention from their true purpose.
Yes. I mean, the thing is that they've been after global governance for forever, and they're using these various pretexts in order to establish it. You know, it just so happens that they love global crises because global crises call for global governance to address them. And so they really...
Transnational solutions, right?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And as Alex was talking about, you know, the extent to which they have taken control, specifically the Chinese Communist Party, of the organizations greatly facilitates their ability to manipulate them in furtherance of these agendas. I did want, before we run out of time, just to come back to something you said earlier, Dr. Recknerwald, because it's so important. The weaponization of businesses.
Yes.
Using this so-called environment social governance agenda, ESG, as a means of in running, you know, our constitutional legislative processes, for example, and enforcing the diktats of entities like the World Health Organization, even before it has the authority to dictate to us public health policy. This is of critical importance. And I know that people like Larry Fink at BlackRock have been masterfully engineering means of essentially compelling corporations. Target comes to mind because they're in the midst of a thrash, as you know, now over their advocacy of transgender ideas. And it was pointed out that, well, you know, they may be suffering something like $12 billion in capital market value loss, but they've got, you know, tens and tens and tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars backing them up, thanks to BlackRock, no?
Yes, exactly. So what this amounts to is that basically the reason why these corporations are going woke and becoming part of what I call the woke cartel is that they have been told in no uncertain terms by Larry Fink and other asset managers who are controlling the lion's share of the world's assets, that is the investments in these companies, their stocks. They have been told in no uncertain terms that if you do not abide by this ESG index and you do not meet the index, the ESG bar,
you will be punished. I hate to cut you off, but I'm out of time. Dr. Rechten will come back and we'll continue this conversation soon. Bless you. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, globalists at the European Union and World Health Organization unveiled a landmark digital health partnership to, quote, facilitate global mobility and protect citizens across the world from ongoing and future health threats, unquote. We're promised, moreover, that, quote, this first building block of the World Health Organization Global Digital Health Certification Network will deliver better health for all, unquote. Actually, what you'll get with this health partnership is international aggregation of your personal data, surveillance, control, and abuse. Even before that dark day arrives, as Dr. Robert Malone has pointed out, bureaucrats in the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology have already launched a national digital health ID here without debate or voters' informed consent. Think of it as your passport to the digital gulag. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of my colleagues and friends at the Center for Security Policy. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He is the director of our Homeland Security and Counterterrorism programs at the CSP. He brings to this a wealth of experience monitoring, analyzing, and warning of enemies domestic, particularly. Co-author and driving force behind a really important book that the Center for Security Policy Press published a few years ago now, entitled Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. He has recently contributed at the American Mind a really important piece about some of those domestic enemies, including Antifa, entitled So Many Ways to Glow. And Kyle, it's good to have you with us to talk a little bit about the Patriotic Front, which is an outfit that I confess I hadn't followed until I saw your piece. And it's curious, to say the least, and provides a kind of prism through which to examine what is going on inside our government in responding to so-called domestic terrorism and what it means for ordinary, patriotic, and freedom-loving Americans. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. I became interested in doing the piece because this group, the Patriot Front, which if you've heard of at all, you know because they routinely do these marches with large banners saying things like Reclaim America while wearing white balaclavas, blue t-shirts, and khakis. I note in the article that they look a little bit like the Cobra troops from the TV show G.I. Joe. And they're sort of a clownish group, a white supremacist group. And among conservatives, the feeling was generally, and if you follow this at all online, you'll see it, that these guys were essentially a provocation. They were, you know, basically FBI agents playing dress up. That's the sense that most conservatives have of this group, the Patriot Front. So I wanted to delve into them and actually figure out, if I could, a little bit about who they were and what we actually know about them. And it turns out we know an awful lot. We know who their founder is. He's a young man whose only real accomplishment in life was that he once served on the student newspaper at his high school. The SPLC breathlessly says that this honed his propaganda skills for his future role on the far right.
But that's... that would be, of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which makes a practice of hallucinating about people's hate groups and, you know, agendas, including, it has to be said, the Center for Security Policy. But the SPLC is conjuring this guy up as some sort of bona fide leader.
Some sort of evil mastermind, right? Which is routinely the case. When the Southern Poverty Law Center bothers to look at actual hate groups at all, instead of just slandering conservative opponents as hate groups, the hate groups that they focus on tend to be laughable. They tend to be small, only a handful of people. There's no evidence that the Patriot Front can really put together large numbers of people to do anything. And the people that they do have are typically unaccomplished, uninteresting, not particularly capable when we think about capabilities in terms of terrorist and extremist groups. So they tend to, groups like the SPLC tend to overinflate threats like the Patriot Front. So why then?
This sounds kind of like the FBI as well at the moment, does it not?
Well, that's exactly right. So why is it that we hear so much about them? And it's because they have been heavily infiltrated by Antifa. Antifa has routinely leaked all of their internal communications, internal videos, their names, their faces, their home addresses. As I said, it's not the case at all that we don't know anything about them. In fact, we know a lot about them because they're breathlessly reported on. So Antifa focuses on them. They push this information out. It's picked up by mainstream or allegedly mainstream journalists who breathlessly report it. It then finds its way into FBI analysis and FBI reporting. They breathlessly report about it. And all of a sudden, they take this group of people who are really not capable of anything and turn them into, you know, the second coming of Mussolini.
Yeah. And in your piece, you talk about FBI agents, according to whistleblowers, getting bonuses for having some kind of quota satisfied in terms of finding domestic white supremacist terrorists, especially. And that they're also using contractors, including Antifa, you said, to sort of try to monitor or maybe even participate inside this Patriot Front for the purposes of making somewhat more plausible the idea that this is a real threat. Is that right?
Well, that's the hypothesis. So the Media Research Center recently released a video of a DHS panel featuring a professor from the University of Cincinnati, I think it was, who openly admitted to being an anti-fascist, to openly admitting engaging in illegal activities in order to dox and target people they considered opponents. And he said that he had, and I'm paraphrasing here, multiple conversations with the FBI about his illegal activities. So apparently the FBI is well aware that groups like Antifa engage in illegal activities. And yet they still maintain open conversations with them, and Antifa professors are still invited to DHS panels to talk about the danger of the far right. And so that was the concern that I have, is that we're seeing a sort of mixture between the academic, quote unquote, countering violent extremism milieu, right? Where they get government grants, they get money to do programs that says that far right extremism is the greatest threat, and actual hardcore Antifa, which is engaging in intelligence gathering and doxing of their opponents for their own political fanaticism.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing a merger there.
Quite
and
possibly.
That in turn is feeding up into the federal government.
Yeah, Kyle, that's where I want to go next with this. We have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy and an expert on the truth about domestic terrorism and more right after this. Welcome back. We have in the house virtually Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy, the director of its Homeland Security and Domestic Counterterrorism Programs. Kyle, you were laying out for us this rather bizarre situation in which a group called the Patriot Front seems to be essentially an op, as they say, the disinformation at best and at worst, something that is used to justify, well, it seems surveillance and arguably repression against an awful lot of actual patriotic Americans. What I would be particularly interested in is how the FBI's manipulation, penetration, and use of contractors, including in your article at The American Mind, Antifa itself, to work inside and conjure up a greater threat from this Patriot Front outfit. Talk us through whether that crosses, well, legal restrictions on domestic spying by the FBI.
So this is one of the things that I think is so interesting. So the FBI and the federal government in general is, of course, limited in what they can do in terms of dealing with informants, human sources, and so on. They have regulations, they have restrictions. All of those things are going to come out if they go to court in front of a jury, etc. So they're somewhat limited in what they can do with actual federal employees. But there is no limitation for them to accept information from anyone. So you have groups, either private contractors or groups like Antifa, who are funneling information into the federal government. They can take advantage of that information, even if that information was procured illicitly. The concerning thing about this is the Biden administration has explicitly said in their countering domestic terrorism strategy that they published early on in the administration, that they wanted to expand the ways that the federal government could take advantage of outside information and outside, essentially, contractors to gather information that they themselves were not entitled to gather. So this enables them to look and essentially surveil groups that they have no criminal case on. Typically, law enforcement's not allowed to look at you unless they have a reason to open a case, right? But a private contractor can monitor groups on contract with the federal government essentially without a problem. So they are essentially skirting the laws about what they can and can't do by using private contractors and by using these fringe politically motivated actors like Antifa who feed them information on groups that they may otherwise not be permitted to surveil. And so that's the concern that I have. And the Biden administration is pretty much openly saying that this is how they want to proceed because they have all these annoying limitations in terms of what they're allowed to do. The other advantage this gives you, of course, is if your data is collected by private actors or it's provided to you by political organizations that you have no technical affiliation with, it allows you to go before Congress and say with a straight face that there were no informers in a group, that there were no human sources involved in an activity because it was all done essentially out of house.
This is wrong on so many different levels, Kyle. And I guess just to come back to where we started, you've written a book about the growing danger of Antifa in the United States. The idea that the FBI is actively collaborating with Antifa to conjure up a threat that is not Sears, not growing, not maybe even real, from so-called white supremacists and conservatives who are characterized as domestic terrorists, is it's an affront. It's obviously an abuse of power, and it's arguably creating new vulnerabilities for us on the home front. That it's just as I say, unconscionable, and it should be terminated, it seems to me, at the earliest moment. Kyle, speaking of things that are harmful to our country in terms of policies, I did want to ask you quickly about the border situation. I know you're following it closely. You've been working with local law enforcement and others around the country, contending with the consequences of Joe Biden's effective elimination of our southern border in particular. One of the things we focused on in an important Committee on the Present Danger China webinar last week is some of the health implications of the border going away, notably the prospect of a serious tuberculosis epidemic erupting in the near future, if it's not already underway. There's also talk about measles. There was a report yesterday I heard about the police stations in Chicago now being forced to put on their doors warning, do not enter, or enter at your own risk, because there's a measles outbreak among people temporarily housed inside the police station. This sounds absolutely insane. And especially as we talked about earlier in the program, to the extent it might encourage the effort to have the World Health Organization insert itself into our public health policy practices and directives, is just unconscionable. Your thoughts in a minute.
Well, I mean, I think that what we are seeing is that when you invite the entire world to cross your border with absolutely no kind of legal process, you get all of the problems in the world, whether that's health, the spreading of diseases that we don't have traditionally here in the United States, or that we thought we've eliminated here in the United States, whether it's terrorism, whether it's criminality and crime and drugs. Open borders means you get everything in the world. And that's that's just the way it is, and that's what we're getting. And these are conditions that are being forced on local and state governments that do not have capacities to deal with these things. And the concern that creates is, are they deliberately forcing these local and state governments to deal with these issues to sort of overwhelm them?
Which they're not equipped to do.
Which they're not equipped to do.
Kyle, thank you for your time. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Go forth and multiply.